I just remember going off and listening
Simon Smith
to the Quartet albums for about 2 months, and just sitting in my sitting room in the old house and just writing and writing and writing while listening to the Quartet.
Sam?
Jack Hughes.
The Oyster Bay is in here.
Aha. Uh-huh. That will be that then.
That will be the context.
Thank you.
Are you good at it?
Yeah. What are you doing? Is this yours?
That's mine. And does.
Sam Bailey.
But I'm interested in your objections to having a context, to providing the request to provide a context. But having just spent five years trying to provide a context for my own practice, I'm interested, because you're obviously an academic and as well as a poet.
David Hurd.
Yeah. I don't mind, on the whole, providing a context for other people's work. I have a deep aversion to providing a context for my own, I think.
Mm.
But I do also think that some work should just voice itself.
Mm.
And people can work it out for themselves. And that's part of the pleasure of it. But I think by context, partly what's meant is just how did it come about in the first place?
Mm.
That's partly it.
But I mean, it voices its own context, because a lot of it is about what was going on at that particular moment.
What, in the performance or
in the text? I mean, for my part anyway, I was just throwing in things from. Yeah, the beginning of the Arab Spring, and there's all that stuff in there. But that's just one part of everything else that got thrown in. So it's kind of actually about... Is it part of the...
Don't you think that procedure is more interesting than context? Because procedure carries context with it. So we collectively had to produce a piece.
Yeah.
And we were really quite worried that we had to produce 45 minutes of poem.
Yeah.
That's like an album.
Yeah.
And we had about 3 months from the time we started to do it.
And normally it would take you 3 years to do something like that.
Yes, I mean, it felt like the best part of a book's worth of poetry in 3 months.
Had you guys worked together in that kind of collaborative way before?
No.
No.
Well, I'd never done a collaboration at all.
No. Neither.
Really?
No.
Well, I assumed you had some kind of history.
No.
That's interesting.
Not in that way.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And, I've been endlessly surprised at how... I mean, meeting you guys and working with you guys, how it's kind of... It seems to have worked.
It's very generative.
Yeah.
Of work. The whole situation.
Yeah.
Has your subsequent poetry been influenced by... work through in any way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I've found is that the requirement to work at speed.
Yeah.
Means
really
that
good.
you don't absolutely like everything you do, but it forces you into new directions that you wouldn't have got to otherwise.
You don't feel crabbed, and you don't feel kind of. You have to sort of suspend the editor on the shoulder.
Mm.
You know, the editor comes along later. Whereas the way I've always worked in the past is the editor is always activated in the process of doing it.
Mm.
Whereas for this, it wasn't.
No.
And what we've done is, as the whole thing... Because the whole thing, with each time we've met to create... a new version of this, it's been further edited through time. So actually it's been edited over quite a long period, really. At least six
sort of mutated
months
over
to a year.
Yeah.
Easily. And I think that you, from what I can hear, you've been doing the same thing with the music.
Yeah. And I think we've reached the end of that process, actually, but Well, you were definitely adding pieces at the beginning of this year, weren't we?
But how is it, thinking about the composition right at the beginning? Because there were no words at that point.
No.
Was it always going to be modular in the way that...
Yeah, I just think... I remember after the meeting with you guys thinking that the worst thing I could do would be to sort of wait to have some poetry from you and then try and set it to music, you know. So the best thing was just to create music that would, sort of collide with the text. I think I always wanted that to be part of it. Mm. But I think, a bit of context is useful for the music in that we had, Sam and I had just begun to work with Loran and Mark. Well, actually, you've worked with Mark, Loran and Mark before, haven't you? Mm. But for me, it was beginning to work with them. And they are musicians who, well, they free jazz is their language. So the more you tell them what to do, in my experience, the less great they are.
Right.
So you have to create space for them all the time. And as a composer, that really means getting out of their way. So it's like giving little sparks, but not over-composing. You know? And I think I definitely got to a point where I wanted to get out of the way and sort of just trigger things rather than be constantly trying to shape everything. You know? So that was a good space for me to be in.
The other collaborators who aren't present, I mean, it wouldn't be possible without Mark and Loran and
then playing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with other players. With them, and then our working relationship. There's all of these kind of resources which had been built up prior to the piece.
Because I remember that we did a rehearsal with another bass player, a friend of ours, didn't we? And at his house, and we sort of played it for a while, and after about 15 minutes he went, I can't do this.
He gave up playing the bass in the rehearsal.
Oh, no!
Yeah.
And he is one of the best bass players we've ever worked with. Yeah. I mean, he's an awesome musician. In the top five musicians I've ever worked with.
He's subsequently taken up the bass again, but he did stop the bass for a year or so.
So this was so traumatic, he actually gave up.
It was
part of the constellation.
The icing on the cake, a series of double bass-related traumas, yeah.
Right, okay.
And he became a plasterer for a while.
So the whole thing was really a bit of a... It was a huge risk, looking back at it, really.
And for us, I'm not sure that there was so much risk, in a sense, in that it's what you do as a...
I never collaborated with another writer, let alone collaborated with musicians or composers. Mm. Never done that at all. I didn't know what to do.
The timescale and the fact we didn't know each other meant that the editor was out of the equation, like you're saying.
Yeah.
And I think when the editor's not there, then serendipity... Yeah. Normally takes over and gives you, and you take these things as gifts. But normally the way art working is structured doesn't leave much space for that.
No.
But I think partly because the slightly disorganised nature sounds new, in fact we didn't know each other, thrown together at last minute, it's all of those things contributed. This is one of the things which helps free range, I think, the fact that it's slightly disorganised and there's no time to do anything. And my faith in that working method was definitely enhanced by what we've done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I remember you sent over the lyrics to Marcy, and you said something like, this might be fuel towards the end of the poem. And I needed something, and I sat down and wrote through the lyrics in the way that, you know, people do. And that's how it was going all along, it seemed to me, that, you know, you'd get a fragment of something. Yeah. And that would be what would propel the next little bit.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the music, it seems like it's sort of 10 unrelated pieces. But when I was writing it, I really felt that they belonged together. You know? In fact, there was one piece that was just bolted on the end. But even that feels like it belongs. I know it's sort of, I don't know, it's hard to, one can't justify it or even explain it, but... But all
it
the
was
pieces.
A sense of A, isn't A minor? A is some kind of modal thing around A, because the first section and the main minimalistic section. And some of the later sections have got that A pedal throughout it.
Yeah. And I guess the way that it goes to sort of B flat in that A pedal section is sort of deliberate. And the way the last section is in D is sort of work somehow, because a lot of the A is like a dominant preparation.
That D minor bit. Yeah. I see. Okay. Yeah.
For the musicians.
Well, I'm glad that's sorted out.
But there is a lot of A-ish.
One of the things which has kind of come out of rehearsal and through gigging it is the kind of long-term rhythms of the piece. Like knowing where it's right to get the climax and knowing where it's right to let go a little bit. And those things weren't there at the beginning and have developed and we required them.
No, it was quite interesting working on the recording because I was working on the thing that we did just before Christmas. Because when we initially performed it, we were playing Ornette Coleman's Lonely Woman as an intro, weren't we?
Yeah.
And then we were going to record it like that, and then Mark and Lorraine basically said, oh, no, we don't want to do that.
Not going
to
do that.
Can't record that. That's just too close to the bone. So I wrote the new beginning piece, like, literally the night before we recorded it, didn't I? Gave everyone the parts. So the recording of it is really, like, nobody knows what the hell was going on, basically, do they?
Because, well, I think what happened then was we read through the whole and it was really long.
Right.
And you just said,
well, that was it, yeah.
Why don't you cut some bits? Yeah. So we just started cutting stuff.
But we did it really on the fly. Mm. We were doing it literally as we were recording it.
So again, necessity was the main...
But the thing was, you didn't know what I was cutting and I didn't know what you were cutting. No, we were doing it.
Yeah.
Which was kind of interesting.
I remember thinking that the real, the only real criterion would be, does a line stand up in and of itself?
Yes, exactly.
Is that line interesting?
Yeah.
And then is the next line interesting?
Okay.
In any way?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Do they stand as freestanding lines? Because you could never tell what was going to be heard.
No.
And therefore, any given, you know, all you could ask was that any given line had some interest value to it.
Yeah.
And so how does all this relate to Biotherm? Which was the original kind of starting point for you guys.
I was just going to say that that's an important bit of context, because I remember you giving me a copy of Biotherm, and that really interesting commentary on it as well.
Yeah. But it's more kind of, that is more kind of to do with sources, really, than anything else.
But it was a great kind of
catalyst
for the music, in a way, because that fragmented way that Biotherm works and...
What's important about Biotherm is that it is a very late work by O'Hara.
Mm.
It's not one of the, it's one of the last things he wrote, isn't it?
Yeah.
So therefore, and him dying early and so tragically, really, it kind of points towards where he might have gone, which is quite different from the kinds of things that he's known for, like lunch poems and these kind of idea that poems, which kind of follow a certain narrative. And Biotherm, I mean, when he talks about writing this poem, it's about disrupting the narrative of it. Whenever it started to kind of make sense, you disrupt it. But also, it was about trying to make it as long as possible.
That was the thing that it was about. So the thing about Biotherm is, the question about Biotherm is, how does this poem sustain itself?
Yeah.
How does it get from one section to the next? He's writing over this long period, but writing quite quickly.
And so therefore, the
poem is constantly absorbing... Yeah. New material in order to just keep yourself going, and that just so that seemed like a good model.
Mm. Well, it's the kind of question that
we were going to have to do.
Well, it was the kind of question that we had. You know, how are we going to do that in the context of working with?
I think we also thought unless we had some point of departure in common, then the fragmentation could become unmanageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that Biotherm got left behind pretty quickly, didn't it? Mm. I don't think we quoted any of it, actually. Amongst all the things we quoted, I don't think we quoted that.
No.
Right.
But that's
okay. Getting to know Frank O'Hara's poems and noticing all your bits. Mm. Oh, that's, David says this bit, oh, Simon says this bit.
Yeah.
It's all there. It's all
retrospectively, I kind of, you know, got all the references.
Yeah.
I remember as well watching Mad Men a lot around the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Writing this, and Don Draper... is reading a book of Frank O'Hara's poems in one episode, and I thought that was a nice bit of synchronicity.
He's reading Meditations in an Emergency.
Exactly right.
But then we also started to quote from things that O'Hara quotes from. So O'Hara is very interested in Markovsky, so I went back and looked at Markovsky and decided to put stuff from Markovsky in there.
And you heard Ode to Markovsky. Didn't you have a poem about Markovsky?
I started then to generate... That's the other thing that happened with the text that we then had. we started to cut it about on our own. You know, we just went off and started to make new poems out of Wrote Through that were kind of shorter and, I don't know about more lyrical, but they kind of started to kind of form into another kind of text again.
Like we've done with elements of the composition.
Right.
We played it last Thursday, the London composition, a separate thing.
Right.
So it's interesting they have life
beyond as well. Mm. Yeah. And around it. Mm. Very interesting, yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about Mayakovsky as well. There's one of the models for me when I was writing it, in terms of the sound world, was Luciano Berio's Sinfonia.
Mm-hmm.
And that third movement that has, I think, 8 voices sort of reciting bits of poetry and bits of stuff. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. And, yes, and in that piece, you know, the music sometimes gets so big that it overwhelms the readings, so you can't hear what's being said. And that was something I always felt would be an exciting... Because we're talking about all the sort of fragments, in a sense, aren't we, that make up Wrote Through. But in terms of the overarching sense of it, it was this sense that at times you would just have, you know, music, and at times you would just have poetry, and at times you would have the two elements colliding. And at other times, the music would, because it can, because it's as the volume, would be able to overwhelm the poetry.
Yeah.
But you just keep reading, and it sort of didn't matter that you couldn't hear what
I felt
being
that was
said.
A really exciting process right from the beginning. That
I
was
thought
a really
that tension was
prospect.
Something about Wrote Through as a piece that that it does that it kind of just
and the sheer fact that the voices, which are, you know, they're so precious in a poetry reading, could get obliterated periodically, and then the poem would start to obliterate itself.
Yeah.
I thought that was was exciting.
Yeah.
The Tower of Babel sense of people reading over each other and it being an information overload. I love that.
Yeah, and I think that when a performance of it or a recording of it works really well, then you get that, and then you get moments of clarity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either in the playing or in the reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of relief that really works for me.
Well, serendipity, isn't it? It's it's a piece which kind of opens up to and relies on and utilises serendipity as a really as a primary resource, and it has done on all sorts of levels.
Yeah.
But you say serendipity, I think some of it's more forced than that implies. Because I think the writing sometimes used what came along, but sometimes just had to be forced because there was a deadline and a certain amount of material had to be generated. And so some of it just comes out of the forcing, I think.
Yeah. But there are counterbalances to that, and what I find really exciting about the whole project anyway is the way there's a kind of respect going on all the time. I've never had any sense of, I mean, entering into this in the first place, I was really worried about egos and all this kind of thing, and, you know, trying to control what we were doing, and actually no one individual has tried to control this project at all, it seems to me. Do you know what I mean? There's no... So people have allowed space to, you know, for people to do things they needed to do and just let it go, not to try and shape the whole thing into something that will become a sort of... it kind of has an overall vision. So it becomes a sort of multi-faceted thing. And
it's
in performance.
It's more common in music than it is in poetry.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's like there's no definitive version. So, you know, we go off, we do a gig somewhere, and that's it, you know, and it's great. You know, the one in Deal was one thing. The one in London was another. You know, what we've just done is another thing altogether. And that, I think, is the wonderful thing about this, is that... And so the next time we'll do it, will be something else again. And that's great.
Yeah, I love that about it.
Mm. It keeps it interesting.
Mm. But there is a tension... What's interesting is the friction between...
Yes.
It having an identity, a repeatable identity, and its individual instances. And I find that, as an improviser, I find that really interesting.
Mm.
And how much of that is the people involved, how much of it is the text, how much of it is the musical notation, how much of it is... Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
There's
mm.
all sorts of constant factors and...
There's an interesting formal tension, though, in the fact that that you're improvising, and there's a degree to which we're not, even when we're adjusting and modifying and altering, we're not improvising.
No.
In anything like the same way.
But this is a spectrum of improvising. I mean, maybe you are improvising less than we are, but I mean, improvisation is essentially just reusing stuff you
have. Well, it's
called... the process is the same kind of process, but to a different degree, if you know what I mean. It's a...
Also, the piece is written, the music in the piece is written, you know, anything from an instruction to play a certain way, isn't it? There's a piece where it just says play in a sort of swaggering medium swing.
Yeah.
So anything, in other words.
Really fast.
Yeah, and then there's another, and there's another thing where it's written, you know, that the systemic sounding section where it's actually written out pretty, where we change the chord is free, but the what we're playing within any given moment is pretty mapped out, you know. So again, that was something I was quite interested in, you know, and I'm constantly interested in the degrees of improvisation and composed music and the spaces between them. You know?
I'm interested in that as well. I'm just wondering, I'm interested in whether Simon is, does it alter your sense of the relation between the written word and the spoken word?
Yeah.
And
it has done, Yeah.
Does it make you trust the spoken improvised word more, or not? Still not?
Well, I become more and more interested in that anyway, because... So it's just kind of helped me on that trajectory, really. In that, you know, I came from the sort of school of... You know, this goes back a long, long way. From the school of English literature, where a poet reading their poems was a complete no-no. You know, that was... Because it meant that they were somehow interpreting their own work. So there was all that, this stuff about authorial intention that could creep into it. Mm-hmm. And so Dylan Thomas is seen as being, you know, one of the real culprits in all of this. But actually, over the years, I then found that if I did listen to a recording of poets for whom I had... I just hadn't found a way into them. Then hearing them read their own work, suddenly I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And they very often become... poets that I've really embraced. So W.S. Graham would be one of them, but O'Hara is another one as well. And so it's just kind of carried on that trajectory of performance actually becoming more and more important.
But you do want the text, don't you?
Yeah, but the text has become something, you know, rather than the voice being something that hobbles you in terms of how you might understand a poem. It's become a way, it's actually become an access to it. And the text has become something, just pure text has become something that I find something that hobbles you now.
Mm.
Do you think you'd want to do a piece where you were improvising?
Well, I slightly disagree with David, because I think we do improvise. Because, you know, just now, what I was doing was... And by improvising, what I mean is that I had a pile of paper here that I was kind of sifting through and then reading out bits off it. But the reason why I was reading the bits that I was reading was because those were the pages that didn't stick together. It was something as physical and kind of happenstance as that. So that's why I chose those pages. And it was immaterial as to whether the text was something that I generated or you generated. And so at that level, at least, it had a kind of improvisatory aspect to it.
I've got to that point as well. So I think there was a point when we were reading across each other when each of us was trying to work out what might be a good passage to read against the other's passage.
Yeah.
And that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
But your question is a really good one, which is, could you just stand up and speak? That's the question you're asking.
Yeah, really. A bit like, you know, the section in Wrote Through where it says, play really fast.
Mm. Right.
You know.
Well, actually, we're not just playing really fast. We're doing a version of Miles's Freebop from 65.
You see, I think,
aren't we?
Yeah.
So we have a model.
Yeah. That always,
But I think there's something really interesting here about in the question of where writing and performing coincides.
Yeah.
And so it sounds to me like when you're improvising, in effect, there's a writing process going on. So when one is writing a poem, that's you're plainly improvising, whether you're working with text, there's plainly improvisation involved. But what you don't bring to the performance is you don't bring that level of writerly concentration that allows the speaking to be a pure flow of poem, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
That's why you need the text.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
One of the key metaphors that I used in my PhD was this. Gary Peters had wrote this book called The Philosophy of Improvisation. He's talking about stand-up comedy and all sorts of different types of improvisation. But he talks about Scrap Heap Challenge, that reality TV show, where people go into a scrapyard and there's blue team and red team and they have to make something. They have to make a racing car or something like that. And he's saying the improvisers like this, they're kind of put into this scrap heap of discarded musical tropes and kind of cliches and the remnants of things half forgotten. And suddenly they have to scrabble together something which is coherent and functional. And it seems, and I understand improvisers do that, but it's clearly what you guys are doing as well. By scrabbling together.
The difference is, though, that we do it in the privacy. We do that act in the privacy of, well, you know, wherever it is that one writes. But as improvising musicians, you're doing it in public.
Yeah.
We're not used to that. I don't think we're really used to that mode of assemblage being in public. So we can muck around with the text that we've got in front of us in a quite significant and I think interesting way. It's interesting to me, to us. But I wouldn't find it very easy to walk into a gig with no text and start talking.
Yeah.
Because the intellectual space would be unusual.
Yeah. To say the least, yes.
But you are constructing from from that text there. You're constructing.
I wonder whether you could sort of build like a text framework, as it were, from which you would spring off into bits of improvisation, or kind of like we do in the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that other writers do. I mean, I think that's sort of I think that.
If you were able to over time commit this to memory, then you'd have this material at hand.
Yeah.
You sort of mean.
But then to kind of jumble it would be quite difficult. But I think your theory of improvisation, although it's a good one, it sort of leaves out the... So I'm thinking of some of those Coltrane improvisations, where he sort of goes on for like 30 minutes with some impressions or whatever it is that he's playing. Do you know what I mean? And there's a kind of slow, like, jumbo jet in slow motion sense of the thing taking off. And at a certain point, it does actually levitate, you know. And there's the tension between the musicians sort of creates a sort of, I don't know what it is sort of thing. But it goes beyond that I think, slightly tired sense of recycling objects all the time, you know.
In the moment at which we are reading this stuff, you know, you throw up a challenge, whether it be, oh, they've suddenly gone quiet. So what do we do with this? Do we read over it? Do we kind of, at this moment, is it the right thing to obliterate that? Or is it the right thing to step back, write back, and say nothing? Or do we carry on at a certain level, so we can hear the words and the music? What do we do with this? And that's constantly shifting, and it's shifting for all sorts of reasons. It's shifting because of time, it's shifting because of volume, it's shifting for all sorts of different reasons all the time. You know, whether it's, you know, if we end up with Sam playing the piano, well, maybe this time for Sam's piano solo, so I better shut up. But that comes at a moment, usually, that hasn't happened in previous performances. And that, you know, you might have listened, as I have, listened to the recordings that we have again and again and again, but it's in a completely different place. So suddenly, this is another work. It's not, so every time, it is also a new work. So it gives you that challenge every time.
But it means that your piano solo is a kind of documentation that we have to take account of in terms of how we work with this document, which I think is kind of interesting.
Mm. It goes back to friction between that we were talking about between... Well, it's a friction between different levels of memory, I think. And so, you know, what we've listened to, what you've read, and what you've written down, and what I've practiced, and what I physically know, and what Jack has, and what their notation there. Mm. These are all different levels of memory and kind of intention, sedimentary kind of levels of intention and memory.
Yeah.
And then you get the moment, and then something comes to the surface.
Mm. But I think with this piece, there is like... whole is more than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah,
which is what I find exciting about it. This piece can work in all sorts of different fashions, I think. Mm. So, you know, like the Oxford gig with the three musicians. And I think the audience there, that you know, they'll get from it what they get from it. Mm. I mean, it won't necessarily be how we imagined it.
Mm.
If you know what I mean. But true, then my experience of playing music to... to different kinds of people is that everyone really takes from it what they take from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What you think you're doing is not really what you're doing, you know. I think there is a sort of collective sense of what's there, you know.
Yeah.
When you play, like, especially when you're playing to really large crowds of people and stuff.
My favourite version was the free range version, though.
Yeah.
Because I just thought the whole piece felt at its most articulate to me on that occasion.
Yeah.
I thought you could hear the different tones.
Mm-hmm.
At least I could hear them more clearly.
Mm.
And I really think the listening of the audience brings this out.
Yeah.
The acoustics
were
good then, but also
it was also helped at the free range gig that a number of people in the audience, maybe quite a number, had heard it before.
Yeah.
And so you were speaking to familiarity.
Yeah.
And so when
they understood that kind of context.
Yeah.
That it's in, you know.
Flick said that she thought it was the best version that she'd heard.
Yeah.
And she's very hard to please.
Mm-hmm.
People who have objections about the piece very often talk about your accents. And
accents.
I think that they're bullshit, the objections. But they think that poetry should be read in a voice that they're unfamiliar with, or that is somehow exoticised or different, you know. So when they hear it with a Kentish accent or whatever kind of Lancastrian, I'm not sure where your accent is, but...
Leicestershire,
okay.
Yeah. Mine's just Estuarine.
Estuarine?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I find that's very strange. Sean had a similar kind of objection, didn't she? Other people have had this objection.
Mm. But I think...
That's a really important part of the thing, the fact that it confronts you with voices which are your own or might be your own or that you're familiar with or, you know...
Mm. But it's like people...
I'm
having a problem with Robert Wyatt singing, you know, because he sings in this very kind of, you know, just brutally English, refusing to Americanize, to make it have that sort of, like, more, whatever Americanization does to pop singing, you know. I mean, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I find
the reading of poems constantly difficult, though, don't you, in that way?
Yeah, I find this really fascinating, because when I do lectures... The number of people that come... And it doesn't matter what I've said. You know, obviously, they've not listened to what I've said at all. But they've actually... They said, you've got a great voice for lectures. And the number of people who have said that independently is really weird. So to hear that... So in that context, it's all right. But in this context, it's not.
People think of poets reading as maybe T.S. Eliot or...
But Eliot's a terrible reader. I mean, Eliot reads this kind of terrible monotone.
It sounds like he puts it on. I mean, he can't possibly have spoken like
that. But what I like about this, when it's working well, especially when all the sounds are going together, is that you get away from a single voice voicing the poem.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
So you know, the kind of thing that one wants to write is a poetry where, you know, there are all kinds of textures, like in the music, and no single voice could possibly do it justice because they don't all come from one place.
Exactly.
And it's always a disappointment to me when you hear the poem, even at its best, when you hear it voiced by only two voices.
Mm.
I'd like millions of voices.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
That's interesting.
Definitely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, or almost. So Olsen had this idea of a middle voice, and I think it's not even a, it's not to do with the voice itself. It's to do with the ear, really. But when you're reading a poem, you're not hearing it. When you're reading a really good poem, you're not hearing it being voiced.
Mm.
It operates in some different space altogether.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's almost impossible to achieve that in speaking, which is a regret. I don't know. Do you know any readers who do that, really?
But you're talking about, you know, that when you read a poem, there's like an idealised voice in your head.
Yeah.
And that when you start speaking, it's shit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is just like being a musician, isn't it? Sort of, you
know. Reading the score, yeah.
Is that...
Exactly the same.
Is it?
Mm.
Right.
Mm. Schnabel used to say that he would only play music that was better than it could be played.
Mm.
So he would play, you know, Mozart, Schubert, Beethoven. Because on the page, it's so absolutely perfect that translating it to real life is going to fuck it up somehow, you know?
Yeah.
And yet there are great readers of poetry. I mean, Tony Lopez is a great reader of his poems.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And Stephen Rodifer's a great reader of his poems.
Mm. Mm.
But there are many different ways of doing it. I know. Do you enjoy reading?
Sometimes.
Because I've come to enjoy it. I used to hate it to begin with. I used to just do it as a chore.
I noticed you were sneering at your voice when we heard it back on the iPad there. I mean, I thought you would have got used to your voice.
Yeah, well, that's different. Hearing it from in here is different.
Right.
I don't know. I don't like the sound of my voice. What I do like is being able to read the poems and each time being able to kind of fall on different places for stresses.
But that's what I like about reading in this context.
Yeah.
Most readings feel like a foreclosure.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're doing anything with words, then usually what you're doing is you're proliferating meanings.
Yeah.
The minute you intoned them, mm-hmm. then you've given it a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the really nice thing about this is that that's constantly being exploded.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I heard you doing that I hadn't heard you do before was repeat certain things, like cut, and those kind of things. There was more of that happening this time now than before. And I like that.
Mm.
And clearly there's quite a lot of improvisation in there. Like, how many times are you going to repeat that? Exactly when do you put the rhythm in? Is it regular? Do you stop? And then you started reading unison and you chose, I think maybe you heard it was going slightly out and you chose to make that a feature. I don't know if that's deliberate. But it started banging unison and then you kind of deliberately started making it go wonky and...
Mm.
And then Nefertiti, man.
You what?
Like Nefertiti.
Nefertiti, yeah.
Mm.
That's what you do that poets don't do, is you listen to each other. Mm-hmm. On the whole, poets don't listen to each other.
Yeah. No, they don't.
They listen to, you know...
Themselves.
The voices in their heads.
Yeah. Absolutely.
When you speak to actors, they actually say, well, musicians don't work as a team. They spend hours in practice rooms all by themselves, or composers spend times at their desk just doing their own thing. And so actors have to work as a team far more than musicians. So there's this kind of spectrum of ensemble improvisation which spans different kind of practices.
Yeah. Yes, but you see, I have real problems with actors. Because what they don't do, they don't listen to poets, that's for sure.
Well, do you think we've said enough?
Yeah.